This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Green Party vice presidential candidate Ajamu Baraka blasts Hillary Clinton's war plans in Syria. And the national grassroots organization Journey for Justice calls for a moratorium on charter schools.
But first, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton argued for 90 minutes at last week's presidential debate, but very little emerged in terms of concrete policy proposals. Trump and Clinton clashed over police stop and frisk policies, which were ruled unconstitutional as practiced in New York City. Trump said the country needs more stop and frisk. Clinton said it was an ineffective way to fight crime. For those who are not schooled in the law and the history of stop and frisk, the whole exchange might have seemed murky. So we spoke with Chip Gibbons, the Policy and Legislative Counsel for the Bill of Rights Defense Committee.
If you weren't familiar with stop and frisk, either in New York or nationally, the exchange that Clinton and Trump and Lester Holt had was incredibly confusing. Stop and frisk can actually refer to two things, one of which is the New York program, which they were clearly referring to, one of which is the wider practice of stop and frisk, which the New York program was based on and was a dramatic escalation of. The original stop and frisk idea actually dates back to a 1968 Supreme Court decision called Terry versus Ohio. And in that case, there was a man named Terry. A police officer decided that he thought Terry looked like he was about to rob a jewelry store. He had no probable cause of this. So he stopped Terry to do an investigatory stop. And then he felt unsafe from this man that he had stopped. So he frisked him and found a weapon on him. Terry's lawyer, of course, moved to have the weapons out of court, being like, why would this ever come into court? This police officer had no probable cause to search my client. And the Supreme Court decided in an 8-1 decision that the stop and frisk practices were okay, that an officer could stop someone on the street, even if they didn't have probable cause, so long as they had reasonable suspicion, and that he or she, the police officer, could then frisk the individual to see if they had a weapon on them. And the rationale for the second part was that the officer wasn't looking for evidence. He was just, you know, looking to maintain his own safety, which, of course, is nonsensical. The officer was definitely digging for evidence, but that seemed lost on 8 members of the Supreme Court. Only one member actually dissented. That was William O. Douglas. And he said that this was putting America down a path to a totalitarian society. The really interesting thing about this that gets us to the New York case is that there was no mention of race in the Supreme Court's decision. This is in spite of the fact that the NAACP Legal Defense Fund wrote a very eloquent amicus brief in this case saying, we're not speaking on behalf of people who have been stopped and have weapons on them. We're speaking on behalf of the average African-American citizen who is subjected to police harassment on a regular basis. And if you say this practice is okay, you're opening the door to racial profiling. And the Supreme Court never once mentioned that in the ruling, which is fascinating for another reason, because as the law professor at Georgetown, Paul Butler, pointed out in a very interesting article called The White Fourth Amendment, the reason why the officer was suspicious of Terry was because he saw Terry, an African-American man, talking to a white man. And to the Cleveland police, if an African-American man is talking to a white man, it can be for no other reason than to plot a crime. And the Supreme Court was actually not oblivious to the impact of this. Justice Brennan actually sent a letter, a private letter, to the Chief Justice Warren, warning him that he was concerned that their decision would open up license to the aggressive surveillance of communities of color that the police were already engaged in. But in spite of those concerns, Justice Brennan, just like Justice Thurgood Marshall, joined in with the majority in saying this was okay. So police departments all over the country used this sort of stop and frisk practice. But what happened in New York was that under Bratton and Giuliani, they dramatically escalated this program. It continued through Bloomberg, and they would, you know, stop people on the street. They would ask them questions. They would frisk them to see if they had weapons on them. And there was a huge number of stops, and a court heard a complaint against the program. And in spite of these very low standards put on police departments for engaging in stop and frisk, this court still found that the program couldn't even live up to those minimal standards and that it was an indirect form of racial profiling. After this decision came out, the state attorney general for New York reviewed the stop and frisk data for 3 years. He found that only 3% of any stop at all ever led to a conviction, an even smaller number than that for violent crime. And if you look at the ACLU's data on stop and frisk, 10% of those people who stopped are white. The rest are all black and Hispanic. So you see huge numbers of African Americans and Hispanics stopped for no real reason because they seldom uncovered a gun. I think something like 0.1% of all frisk uncovered a weapon. So if you were trying to tackle violent crime, it's an extremely inefficient way of doing so. But it really doesn't matter if it's efficient or not, because there's no excuse for racial profiling. And the interesting thing that Hillary Clinton said that was absolutely incorrect was that part of the reason why the New York Stop and Frisk program was found to be unconstitutional was because it was ineffective, when in fact the judge refused to hear arguments about its effectiveness on the basis that those don't have anything to do with whether or not it's constitutional. If a program infringes on civil liberties and violates the Constitution, it doesn't matter at all if it's effective or ineffective. But Hillary Clinton did not really go to the argument about racial justice or constitutional rights. She immediately went to the idea of effectiveness. And you can also ask yourself the question, effective at what? I mean, certainly stop and frisk was not effective at finding guns or anything like that, but a New York State Assembly member alleges that the police chief told him that the point of stop and frisk was to frighten people of color, to make them afraid to leave the house without being stopped by a police officer. And if your goal is to terrorize people of color, to terrorize working class people, to remind them that, you know, anytime they can be stopped by the police, then I suppose you can make an argument that stop and frisk is effective in doing that. The other thing that's worth pointing out is that Donald Trump said that stop and frisk is necessary to reduce violence. That's only the case if you ignore police violence against African Americans. We've seen a very large number of high-profile killings of mostly unarmed African Americans by police officers. These killings are almost always caused by routine police citizen encounters like traffic stops. So if you create a program in which the number of African Americans stopped by the police are going to increase dramatically, then there's a good chance you're probably going to create a situation in which police violence against unarmed African Americans is more likely to occur. So you can only even legitimately begin to say you're reducing violence, which the program specifically does not do, if you completely ignore state violence and police violence.
So the 1968 decision seems to affirm the principle that if you give the police an inch, they'll take a mile, and the Constitution too. And Hillary Clinton's response in the debate calls into question her basic concerns for civil liberties involved here. But Donald Trump also said that this judge, who he described as an anti-police judge, was removed from the case, and there was the inference there, it could have given the impression that judge's decision was no longer valid.
There were a number of procedural maneuvers in the court system after the initial decision was handed down, and I believe at one point the judge was removed from the case. And Donald Trump was right that when the new mayor came in, the new mayor opted not to appeal the decision as Mayor Bloomberg was, and this is largely because of the massive amount of political pressure there was put on the mayor to oppose stop and frisk. The Bill of Rights Defense Committee was part of a local anti-stop and frisk coalition in New York City that did really great grassroots organizing for decades. So in a lot of ways, this is a victory, not so much of the courts or de Blasio, but of the local New York City activists who, you know, really did the legwork here. So yeah, Bill de Blasio did not appeal the decision. That doesn't mean the decision is invalid. It means the decision still stands. Donald Trump is convinced that a higher court would have overruled the lower court's decision. I'm not that convinced of it, but we don't know. Either way, it doesn't matter. A judge made a ruling. That ruling was never overturned. It still stands. Stop and frisk is carried out by the New York City Police Department, was found to be an indirect form of racial profiling that violates the Fourth Amendment and is unconstitutional.
But of course, also the 1968 ruling, which vastly increased police powers on the street, it also still stands.
That also still stands. And many, many cities still have stop and frisk programs, and police officers in New York do still stop and frisk people, just in much lower numbers and not in a systemic way that they used to. A police officer still, per the Supreme Court, only needs reasonable suspicion to stop an individual or stop a vehicle. This is where driving while black comes from, because a police officer can stop any vehicle that has reasonable suspicion of a traffic violation taking place. I mean, there's a large number of minor traffic infractions. You can allegedly pull over any vehicle you want, according to most police. And, you know, this is another great example of the Supreme Court giving the police way too much power. In 1997, the Supreme Court said that so long as there was a reasonable suspicion of a traffic violation, it didn't matter if the stop was a quote-unquote pretextual stop. And that's when an officer pulls over a vehicle based on reasonable suspicion of a traffic violation, but really what he's interested in is some other crime, usually based on his own racial prejudice. So he sees a group of African Americans in a car. He assumes that they are engaged in some sort of serious crime. He follows them around for a couple blocks, and then he sees them, you know, run a stop sign, and then he pulls them over, and he's really not interested in pulling them over because of the stop sign. He's interested in racially profiling them because they're black, but the Supreme Court has also said that's okay because he had a reasonable reason to pull them over, the stop sign infraction, and that they're not going to investigate pretextual stops. So that's another great example of the Supreme Court giving police way too much power. And the Supreme Court does this wonderful thing, and I mean wonderful facetiously, where they say quite adamantly, racially biased policing is unconstitutional, but then with sort of a wink and a nudge to do all this stuff like saying, well, we're not going to investigate pretextual stops. You're going to make it really hard to prove racial profiling. We're going to make it really hard to challenge it. But, you know, in spite of all of those burdens the Supreme Court has put on proving racial profiling, the Center for Constitutional Rights was able to challenge the NYPD stop and frisk program on those grounds. And even with the severe handicap the Supreme Court had placed on them, was able to show that the NYPD program was unconstitutional, which just goes to show you how blatantly racist it was.
We should note that the New York stop and frisk case was well over a decade in the making. And although the Supreme Court says it's unconstitutional to use race, if it takes a decade of assembling statistics to knock down various applications of this doctrine of law, we'd be deep into the middle of the 21st century, grinding out one after another, very slowly, New York type stop and frisk rulings.
Yeah, I mean, that is part of the problem with the legal system, is that it moves very slowly, which is why it ultimately can go to a court to have something declared unconstitutional. You can't make that your only strategy. You've got to look at grassroots activism. You've got to look at social movements. And the stop and frisk case could have gone on for much longer than it did Bloomberg was planning on appealing it, but de Blasio was not able to do so because there was a situation in which grassroots activists had placed political pressure on him, forcing him to accept the lower court's decision. So if de Blasio had continued on the appeal, even if it had gone all the way to the Supreme Court and the city lost, that would have been another very elongated period of time. So that sort of speaks to the importance of not just having a litigation-only strategy, but also, you know, empowering communities, doing grassroots organizing, building strong social movements.
So the next president of the United States will also have to get a de Blasio type of education from these social movements.
Yes, yes, yes. The thing about elected officials is that they don't do anything unless you make them. I believe it was the famous story about Roosevelt. He says to the social movements at the time, make me do it. I don't know if he actually said that. I'm sort of skeptical of that. But it's a good primer on how social change is made. It's not made because politicians or courts are benevolent and, you know, do the right thing of their own accord. It's because when there are strong social movements, when there's strong grassroots organizing, when there's strong pressure from below, they have to make some concessions. I mean, as Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. And regardless of who the next president is, Trump or Clinton, they're not going to make any concessions without a demand.
That was Chip Gibbons of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee speaking from Washington.
World War III could start at any moment in Syria, where U.S. and Russian forces are arrayed on opposite sides of the battlefield. The Russian military is in Syria at the invitation of that country's government. The U.S. is supporting Islamic jihadists and last month killed 62 Syrian government soldiers that were under attack by ISIS. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton has long pushed for a no-fly zone over Syria, although she didn't bring up the idea in last week's debate with Donald Trump. The Green Party has been frozen out of the televised debates. Ajamu Baraka, the Green Party's vice presidential candidate, says peace won't stand much of a chance with Clinton in the White House.
It's clear that a Hillary Clinton administration would be a continuation of the Obama policies in the so-called Middle East, which has been a continuation of the policies of George Bush. And those policies have started under George Bush, the rampage across the Middle East, and now the objective to dismember the Syrian state continues and will continue under Hillary Clinton. That's absolutely clear. So while she may not have had a chance to make the explicit call for or the argument as to why a no-fly zone should be established, we should not be surprised if that didn't come up in the next two debates. And on that point, I mean, there's not much of a difference between those two candidates regarding that situation in Syria. Both of them are committed to maintaining hegemony in the Middle East. Both are committed to using military force to advance the interests of the U.S. in that nation state. So we should expect to see an argumentation put forward as to why there should be even more deeper direct military involvement in Syria.
We know, of course, that your co-ticket person, Jill Stein, advocates that there be an arms embargo against all the fighters in Syria.
That's true. That is a position in which we have a honest discussion about. I think that what she was primarily referring to are those illegitimate forces in Syria. Clearly, the Syrian state is a state. We know that there's already been an arms embargo imposed on Syria, while at the same time, there was an embargo also imposed on importation of oil. But as soon as the so-called rebel forces, or in most cases, the jihadist forces, primarily from ISIS, once they seized the oil fields, the West saw fit to lift that embargo. So I think a more consistent position would be for us to call for a cessation of violence in that area, to bring all parties to the negotiating table, to use the power of the U.S. state to engage in a process of national reconciliation, as opposed to continuing to pursue a policy of militarism. But this notion that there's going to be a simple and direct military solution to this situation that has been created by the U.S. and Western powers is a simplistic one that we have to reject.
Some of us smelled a whiff of the old movie 7 Days in May about a U.S. military coup in the United States when generals of the U.S. military said that they were not sure they'd go along with the ceasefire and military collaboration agreement that had been worked out between the Russians and the United States.
Well, you know, that is an interesting sort of conversation that's circulating. And we know that the incident that really undermined the so-called ceasefire was the U.S. attack on the Syrian army, the first direct and illegal, of course, attack on the Syrian army at Deir ez-Zor, where more than 62 Syrian soldiers were lost their lives, were killed by the U.S. bombing. That was the incident that basically facilitated the unraveling of the partial ceasefire. And it appears to be the basis as to why the Syrian state, along with the Russians, are not prepared to seriously entertain any additional agreements for a ceasefire, and why the U.S. is accusing the Russians and the Syrians of taking a hard line on that position. They have seen, based on the last two ceasefires, that the U.S. does not appear to be serious about a real ceasefire and getting control over its forces that it is providing direct control to on the ground in Syria. In fact, what they have accused the U.S. and its allies of engaging in is using the ceasefires to redeploy, to reinforce their forces, and to be in a stronger position to reverse the military gains that have been accomplished by the Syrian army during those ceasefire periods. So it appears that now they are driving toward a complete military solution, if you will, to the siege of Aleppo.
And we saw Samantha Power, the United States ambassador to the UN, just dismiss the Russians' complaint about the attack on the Syrian soldiers. We know that Samantha Power is on a short list to be Secretary of State if Hillary Clinton wins.
Which should be a troubling possibility for people who are following her positions under the Obama administration. And for people who claim that Donald Trump and his people are supposed to be mentally unstable. And I'm not suggesting she's mentally unstable, but I will suggest that her worldview and her policies are just as dangerous, if not more dangerous, than Donald Trump. But that's the situation we find ourselves in right now, Glenn, that while the Democrats have been successful in fear-mongering people into throwing support to the Democrats, while they have avoided any serious critique of Hillary's policies and the Obama administration's policies, which have been not theoretical, but concrete in terms of what they have engaged in terms of expanding U.S. aggression, drone warfare, murder of U.S. citizens, surveillance. People talk about the coming of neo-fascism under Donald Trump and don't seem to understand that the groundwork, the foundation for neo-fascism has been already created under the Obama administration. And for some of us in our communities, we have already been subjected to neo-fascist state repression. So this is something that we've got to try to penetrate, this inability to see the trajectory of politics in this country, because we all look into the spectacle of Donald Trump and that watching the constant, steady march to the right by the Democrat Party.
And of course, you can't get any further to the right, objectively speaking, than an alliance with Al-Qaeda. And yet the United States seems to be saying that since it can't separate Al-Qaeda, that is the Al-Nusra Front, from the folks that it calls moderate rebels, it won't bomb them, and it will not permit or is ordering the Russians not to bomb them either.
Exactly, and that is problematic. The reason they can't separate the two is because that separation doesn't really exist, and everybody knows that to be the case. And that's why this trial balloon that we've seen floated over the last few days around the notion that the U.S. might need to be more directly involved militarily in order to avoid a humanitarian catastrophe in Aleppo is so incredibly dangerous. Because if you're talking about putting U.S. troops directly in harm's way, if you will, on the ground, the Russians and the Syrians find themselves in a situation where Either they draw back the military activity or they risk the possibility of a direct confrontation with the U.S. It is a very dangerous and reckless floating of that kind of trial balloon. And I'm hoping that the people in the U.S. are watching this, because clearly the corporate media is not paying much attention to it or bringing any kind of real attention to it. And this is a very dangerous occurrence.
The new line that's being circulated by the corporate media and, by the way, by Democracy Now! Is that it is the Russian and Syrian government bombing that is driving the so-called moderate rebels into the arms of Nusra, that is the Al-Qaeda affiliate. But these other factions, including the so-called Free Syrian Army, have been layered and embedded and indistinguishable from Al-Nusra for years.
And that's really the point, that you watch the evolution of this conflict in Syria, then you can't really make that argument. Our argument is not credible. The insurgency in Syria moved from being a so-called civil war into basically an invasion quite quickly, because that was, in fact, the plan that was put in place from 2007. Seymour Hersh revealed that under the Bush administration. So if you're serious and try to understand what's unfolding in Syria objectively, then you will avoid sort of surface and simplistic positions based on preconditioned notions of the character of any of these players, be it the Russians, the Syrians, the U.S., Saudis, Turkey, any of them. You know, what's been missing in analysis in this country in particular, strangely enough, among so-called left forces, is an analysis of objective political forces and looking at the kinds of interests that are in place. Instead, we find the simplistic analysis based on personalities and character. And we have all this theological language of good and evil and all of this. It is incredibly simple and distorting. So, you know, what we see with Syria is a straight up power play based on the U.S. attempting to try to correct the mistakes it made in shifting the balance of power in that region when they were forced to withdraw from Iraq. And that meant they had to undermine the power of Iran by attacking and undermining the Syrian state. It's very simple. And they use the mechanisms they've been using in the past, and that is to whip up a sectarian insurgency, frame this insurgency as some kind of glorious revolutionary process, notwithstanding the fact that there were left and progressive forces in Syria that were making demands on the Assad government, and the Assad government was, in fact, responding to those demands. They went from that kind of reform effort to a military insurgency in a matter of weeks. And it wasn't as a consequence of the repression from the Syrian state. It was a consequence of the unfolding plan that was put in place to dismantle and to engage in regime change in that nation state.
Yes, to many, especially in hindsight, it seems that the attack on Libya was simply the first step in a dance.
Exactly. And they wanted to use that same playbook in Syria. But this time, the Russians, who pretended to be surprised in Libya, decided not to go along with that. It was too dangerous for the Russians to play that game in Syria. And therefore, that's why a second front was opened up in the Syrian conflict. And that front was in Ukraine. So all of these things are interrelated. And it seems to me that if we're going to attempt to understand these conflicts, and if we're going to attempt to take positions that will constrain the reckless power of this U.S. state, that we've got to penetrate the propaganda, get away from the sentimentality and emotionalism, and make clear, objective analysis of the various forces in play. And that is something that we seem to have gotten away from in this country for quite some time, and it's very, very dangerous. And we see the consequence of that by how easily left forces and progressive forces have been manipulated into a blindly supporting the Clinton folks and becoming complicit then in the designs of the U.S. state and U.S. imperialism throughout the entire world.
And let's be clear, according to U.S. military doctrine, as the former Secretary of Defense, Gates, explained it, a declaration of a no-fly zone calls for an immediate destruction of the country's aircraft and anti-aircraft capabilities. And in Syria, that means destroying the Russian anti-aircraft and aircraft capabilities.
Exactly. A no-fly zone is basically a declaration of war. It requires an attack on the facilities, the aircraft of the nation that's in the crosshairs of the U.S. or any country that's attempting to impose a no-fly zone in another sovereign state. At this point, though, that attempt to do that would be, in fact, not only a declaration of war on Syria, it would risk a war with the Russians. And therefore, that would be a very difficult thing for the Clinton administration to carry out. They may threaten that, but I don't see that as a credible possibility. They will be, and I think they will continue to support the invasion by their vassal state, Turkey, and their attempt to try to hold onto territory in the northern part of the country. So we're going to see, I think, a more aggressive effort to dismantle, to dismember the Syrian nation state under a Clinton administration.
Well, that's still one hell of a roll of the dice, since no-fly zones mean war.
Exactly. And so, you know, while the Clinton folks are going to be very belligerent and may even attempt to do that, this is just another example of how reckless in reality the Clinton administration promises to be, as opposed to the recklessness of the language of a Donald Trump, who has never had state power, who's never been in the position to use state power to advance the interests of the U.S. state. And that's part of the analysis that has to be done, that basically we have this constant and obvious activity on the part of the U.S. state under the Obama administration and potentially under Clinton administration versus the bombastic and usually, in many cases, the unrealistic rhetoric coming from the Trump folks in terms of foreign policy. And in many ways, some of the positions of the Trump folks when it comes to, for example, relations with Russia, seems to be softer than the belligerence we see being articulated by the Clinton administration.
And yet, by keeping your ticket, Jill Stein, and you off of the debate, Hillary Clinton is able to masquerade or position herself as the relative peace candidate.
Exactly, the sane one, the one that we should feel comfortable with having access to the U.S. nuclear arsenal, even though people, for some reason, fail to be reminded or remind themselves that under the Obama administration, they have now put in place a plan to upgrade the U.S. nuclear arsenal. And they are developing a process of reducing the nuclear warheads to warheads that some generals suggest can be used in a first strike capacity. So the deployment of U.S. weapons and the dangerous buildup of U.S. forces on the Russian western boundaries, the upgrading of the nuclear arsenal, all of these are supposed to be seen as rational and safe policies being pursued by the Democrats, but instead are supposed to be afraid of some wildness coming from Donald Trump.
Yes, with his $1 trillion plan to create a whole new generation of nuclear weapons, President Obama is projecting the nuclear arms race a generation into the future. And yet he said he was the president who wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons, period.
Exactly. This is the cynicism, the opportunism that we see coming from the Democrats consistently. And it's understandable. But what is not understandable is how easily progressive forces in this country have allowed themselves to be manipulated by the rhetoric of the Democrats and the notion that we are going to be more comfortable, safe, and protected by the Democrats. We are disarming the American people. We are playing right into the hands of rightist forces that are committed to militarism. We are really developing a situation in which the motion of politics toward the right are becoming more and more difficult to counter. When you have the disarmament You have the demobilization of opposition. You have no opposition. We are creating a very dangerous situation for ourselves, and a situation that's always been dangerous but will become even more dangerous for the people of the world.
Here we have Black America, which by all measurements has historically been the most pro-peace constituency in the country, all huddled up in the same big tent that is Hillary's big tent with these professional spooks and generals and strategists for world domination. That must be an uncomfortable fit in that big tent.
It is uncomfortable and is one of the saddest consequences of the influences of Barack Obama and his administration and his presence in U.S. politics, that he has been successful in moving, at least temporarily, a portion of the African-American population to the right, to the point that we see Black folks supporting positions that 20, 25, 30 years ago, we would have never supported in this country. So the Obama administration has been a moral disaster, in my opinion, for Black people.
And yet we seem to see a different kind of worldview emerging among that group that people call the millennials. And I'm speaking of Black millennials.
We do. We see some hope. I mean, we see that there's some, through their own lived experiences, in particular the ones who are involved in oppositional political work, they are beginning to make the kinds of political connections and ideological connections that have to be made in order to become a fighting force in this country. And that's why the Clinton folks are so desperately trying to win some of those elements over to its side, because we see that among the millennials, the attitudes are changing. Even the symbols of national unity, the flag and the national anthem, you have young people around the country now in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick. Now they're taking the knee. So the ideological hold on the consciousness of young people, the jingoism that's so easily used to put people into conformity, we're seeing that that power is being eroded among young people. And I think that is a promising development for progressive and even revolutionary politics here in the U.S.
Ajamu Baraka, vice presidential candidate of the Green Party. Baraka is also an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report.
While Trump and Clinton were debating each other at Hofstra University in New York, G2 Brown was among the protesters demonstrating outside. Brown is a leader of the Journey for Justice Alliance, made up of 40,000 activists and community organizations in 24 cities across the country. The alliance demands comprehensive equality in education and a national moratorium on charter schools.
Our big concern was that the presidential candidates were tone deaf to the flood, I dare say avalanche, of organizing and fight back against corporate education interventions that are targeting Black and brown neighborhoods all over the United States. And we wanted them, instead of having some surrogate say this is what they think, you know, we said let's do this in the spirit of Thurgood Marshall when he was doing his field work for Brown v. Board. And he would go to a school and he'd ask a little girl, well, baby, is your school made out of wood or is it made out of brick? Is your bathroom on the inside or is it on the outside? You know, do you have pencils or do you not have pencils? And this field work grounded his advocacy. And so we say that education policy has to be grounded in the reality faced by people in our neighborhoods. So we are targeting the silence that we've heard, not just from the top tier candidates, but even the, you know, the Jill Steins and you know, the Libertarian candidate. I think that public education should be a top line issue, and the failure of the Obama administration policies, which is to privatize education, that competition is what you need, as opposed to equity, I think is necessary. Our communities, I dare say we will struggle to endure another 4 to 8 years of these types of policies, because where they're closing schools, they're also closing grocery stores, they're eliminating housing. So what's happening is a municipal disinvestment in a particular caste and class of people. And that is how we understand it and how we experience it from a community development perspective. So we develop our platform demanding that the presidential candidates adopt it and just make sure that they know that this is just the beginning. We will not give folks the pass that the president got.
And part of that platform is a demand for a moratorium on school privatization through charters.
Yes, sir. We know that only 1 out of 5 charter schools outperform traditional public schools. We know this. I mean, boatloads of research confirm this. And what's questionable is many of the ones that do outperform traditional public schools, and even the ones that don't, use very tricky enrollment methods. The most involved and active parents get their children into the school. They use very racist push-out methods. So if you're a child with special needs, you're very easily to be pushed out of the school. If you're an English language learner, you know, you're very likely to be pushed out of the school. And we see it all over the place. I mean, you got these success academies in New York where Eva Moskowitz endorses suspending kindergartners, right? Setting up a militaristic environment because the children are violent. Those types of people do not have the right to stand in front of our children. In Chicago, you talk about the school Urban Prep, ran by a brother named Tim King, who boasts 100% of the graduates going to college, but what they don't say is only 41% of the freshmen make it to their senior year. So what happens to that other 59%? Oh, they're in alternative schools. They're in bombed-out neighborhood schools. So it becomes, in essence, school privatization is a $7 trillion a year hustle. And our children are the merchandise, or as they say on the street, the merch. Our children are the merch that is utilized to create enormous profit for these politically connected companies. Now, the charter schools that operate in the spirit of being centers of innovation, and they are out there, we applaud them. So this is not about some anti-charter school rant. It's about the charter school industry and the privatization industry and the impact that closing schools has on neighborhoods, young people, parents, many of our members having to send their children to 3 and 4 schools because they send their child to a school for 2 years, then the school gets targeted and it closes. What we are saying is that the United States has done everything but equity. Online charter schools, expanding alternative schools so that children can go to school that they don't have to get challenged and graduate. And then if they drop out, it doesn't count against the dropout rate. Storefront charter schools in the basement of churches, virtual charter schools, you know, all these different things except for standing up for what Brown v. Board was supposed to do, which is demand and legislate that all schools must be equal. If Johnny, a white kid in a middle school in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, is learning Mandarin Chinese, Spanish, and French in his elementary school, if every teacher in his school has a teacher aide and it's a neighborhood school, then that child in Newark, New Jersey must have the same. And if they don't have the same, it's not acceptable. But we ourselves have been politicized to accept second-class citizenship. So we accept it, and then we begin to blame ourselves for the result of that municipal neglect. And so we are fighting back against that. So, yeah, we absolutely wanted a moratorium on all school privatization and a commitment to equity.
And that's why you're also calling for a national equity assessment of the public schools. And you're not just talking about distributions of money, but the whole educational environment.
Absolutely. You know, in Chicago, I work in the community of Bronzeville, a historic black community in Chicago and well-known around the world. Now, because of what Chicago Public Schools does, and now you have to put your child in a lottery if you want your child to go to a good school and burn tea leaves and whatever else, incense, to try to get your child in a good school. I got my child into a school called Agassiz. Agassiz is a neighborhood school on the north side of Chicago, close to DePaul University. Again, it's not a selective enrollment. It's a neighborhood school. Probably about 35% white enrollment, maybe a little bit more than that. When my son was enrolled in Agassiz, I learned that every teacher had a teacher aide. The children had in their curriculum Mandarin, Chinese, Arabic, and Spanish. They had two fully functional computer labs with computer instructors. They had behavior therapists, speech therapists. They had a school nurse full-time. They had a music teacher, a drama teacher. They had, of course, world language teachers. I mean, every resource and wraparound support that a child needs, they had. And let me be clear, those children deserve it. But then when you go on the south side of Chicago and you go to Mollison Elementary, we have a dedicated core of parents, 6 straight years of improved test scores, despite the fact that it was a receiving school for school closings, and there were 53 kindergartners in one class, one teacher aide in the entire building, a curriculum that did not have world language. That is not bad teachers. That's not ghetto children. That's not disinterested communities. That is a school system that undervalues the lives of Black people. And so we want, and we are conducting, a national equity assessment to lift up everything from curriculum to wraparound supports to after-school opportunities to discipline and how discipline is administered in the school. There was an incident in Philadelphia where one of our members, a brother from one of our member groups, Philadelphia Student Union, a young brother was basically choked out by a police officer because he wanted to go to the bathroom. He couldn't hold it. And he didn't have a pass. And he's 17 years old. And the officer's like, you can't go to the bathroom. He's like, man, I can't hold it. The officer says, oh, go back and get a pass. And he, you know, yells at him. The little brother has an orange in his hand. He slams the orange on the ground. The police officer punches him in the face. The brother's name is Brian Burney. Punches Brian in the face. Puts him in a chokehold, and the brother's on the ground. And he said this. He said, I thought about Eric Garner. I thought I was going to die. Now, the response of the school district was to try to cover it up. But then when we had a rally in Philadelphia, it was interesting. A young white kid from one of the magnet schools there said, got up and he spoke. He said, you know, we fight in our school. So we sell weed. You know, we have sex in different rooms. We play. We do exactly what they do at Benjamin Franklin High School, where Brian went. He said, the difference is we got one police officer in the school. They've got 12. The difference is we don't have metal detectors. They do. So the point being that we've been so criminalized that this young man had to come and bring that truth forward. The difference is not in how we act. The difference is the lens that this system sees me through and the lens that this system sees Brian through. And no truer words could have been spoken. So we're calling that out. And then we're going to push with all of our organizing might to make sure that the results of that equity assessment are acted upon. You know, I ask your listeners to think about this. That the United States in the world amongst developed countries ranks 19th in public education until you take out poverty. You take out poverty, brother, we're number 2. So the issue is not that America does not know how to educate children. The issue is that America does not care to educate Black and brown children. Now, I come from Council of Independent Black Institutions background. Those a lot of my teachers were from, you know, independent Black schools, Shoelays. I developed independent programs in my community. Because some folks will say, well, that's why we got to pull our children out and blah, blah, blah. But the reality is millions of our children are in this system. Millions. So along with doing the independent work in our communities, the Saturday schools, the Freedom schools, which we must do, we must also make sure to the best of our ability that our babies that this system has in those public schools get the very best that we're able to make sure that they get. So, yeah, we definitely going to fight to win equity in public education.
And these demands that are in your platform, they weren't cooked up in some Ivy League tower, but they're the conclusions reached from grassroots people in not just Chicago, but cities all over the country.
Yes, sir. Parents, students, neighborhood residents. Our members, we have folks in Chicago, Birmingham, Alabama, Dayton, Ohio, Pittsburgh, Milwaukee, Minneapolis, Wichita, Kansas, Oakland, California, Los Angeles, Atlanta, Boston, Kilmichael, Mississippi, Eupora, Mississippi, New Orleans, Camden, New Jersey, Jersey City, Paterson, New Jersey, Mount Clair, New Jersey, Baltimore, Brooklyn, New York, Manhattan, Philadelphia. Those are where our people at. And all those cities I mentioned to you, even the rural cities, are cities that have been impacted by school privatization. We are the people that are often spoken about but never spoken to. Never spoken to. You know, we pay taxes too. We have a saying. There are no failing schools in America. As a public, we've been failed. A trust has been betrayed, brother. And so we are expecting the presidential candidates to respond in a way that's responsible, in a way that is not about winning an election, but developing a real education platform. And we are prepared to pressure them, whoever becomes president, as long as we need to. But we are not living with more school closings. We are not living with the explosion of charter schools in our neighborhood. We want equity. Black people want the choice of a world-class neighborhood school within walking distance of their homes, within safe walking distance of their homes. That's the choice we want. We do not want the choice of our children being bused halfway across town because the charter school across the street from my house won't accept my son because my son has special needs or because my son speaks Spanish or my daughter has a learning disability or whatever. No, we will not be the fodder for somebody else's hustle.
Well, there's a lot of damage to be undone. After almost 8 years of the Obama administration, we have seen an unprecedented explosion of charter schools and the federal government acting to coerce states through the Race to the Top program to create more and more and more charter schools.
Despite the fact, like I said, that boatloads of research says that charters do not outperform traditional public schools, despite the fact they can pick the kids they want and kick out the ones they don't. I give you a good example of how charters operate. In Chicago on the south side in our neighborhood, there's a school with two campuses, Woodson North and Woodson South, named after, of course, the late great Dr. Carter G. Woodson. Woodson North was the second highest rated school in our area, maybe about 83% of the children meeting or exceeding state standards. You know, we're not satisfied with 84. But if I get 80, I can see 90. I can work with 80%, right? We can get to 100% from 80. So it was a good school. Did a lot of good things. Strong black cadre of teachers. Dedicated parent base. You know, just a good instructional leader. So what the University of Chicago Charter School did is they took the South Building. They took the Woodson South Building. They began to offer the children at Woodson iPads and other resources in order to come to the charter school. So they looted the top students from Woodson North. And so what happens at Woodson North? Of course, the scores plummet. And so 3 years later, Woodson North is at about 58%. And here comes Chicago Public Schools. It's a failing school. We have to do something for the kids. So we're going to do a turnaround, and they make it a turnaround school. And now the school is a disaster. What is that? That's sabotage. So you took, in a black community that needs good schools like a human body needs blood, and you sabotaged one of its better schools in order to pad the results of your charter school, and then blame the people that you've looted for not having any merchandise. And so that story, brother, is happening all over the country. Now, I say to you, there are charter schools that operate in the traditional form of being centers of innovation, good ones, right? We recognize that. But they are by far the minority in this conversation. Most of the charter schools that operate are, as Dr. Charles Payne said from the University of Chicago, they're mediocre interventions that are only accepted because of the race of the children impact.
Yeah, so in addition to monies and resources and such, you also want accountability to the community. That sounds like community control of schools.
Absolutely. You know, the great author and poet and storyteller Alice Walker said, "No one is your friend who demands your silence but denies your right to grow." So every city that where they're running appointed school boards and state takeovers, we need to reject them because they don't do that in the hills of West Virginia or in rural Tennessee where you got plenty of poor white folk. Those poor white folk get to vote in and vote out their school boards. If those school boards don't operate the way that they need to, they gone. Those people lose their position. But in Detroit, New Orleans, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Chicago, New York, where the primary population is black and brown, we do not have the right to elect or unelect people who can raise our taxes. So schools is one example, but also just in organizing our voices so that the institutions that operate in our community do not operate without our consent, and they operate to a standard that we set. And so this work, what I'm saying to you may sound idealistic, but we have to begin to do that work. We have to. So there are brothers and sisters that are doing incredible work around policing. There are brothers and sisters that are doing incredible work around affordable housing, education, youth investment, right? Health care. One of the biggest victories in the last 20 years in Chicago were young people forcing the University of Chicago to open a trauma center, which they did not want to do. That they fought for 4 years. Now there is a trauma center, a level one trauma center that will be built in our community, you know, that will serve the people. And that was a young people's fight. So what we have to realize is that the issues that we're working in may be where we enter. I entered working with youth, and working with youth eventually translated to community organizing around public education. But what we're really fighting is not an issue. We're fighting a belief system. A belief system. If we say that values are beliefs that govern your behavior, there's a belief system that says it's okay to murder Trayvon Martin in cold blood, or to kill Rekia Boyd, to shoot her in the head and end her life with no accountability, or to strangle Eric Garner in front of millions of people, or to do what was done to the brother in Baton Rouge. And so that's a belief system. That same belief system says it's okay to close 50 schools. And to hell with what happens, because, by the way, who actually are we talking about? We talking about them niggas, so who are we actually talking about? And it's okay. And by the same token, that same belief system says it's okay to deport millions of people who have come to this country and trying to raise their families, and it's okay to separate their families. Just like it's okay to now go to South Dakota and strip the land, rape the land of a people that you've taken everything from, everything from. So, yes, we want the presidential candidates, and we expect them to respond, and we expect an education platform and education policy that acknowledges the decades upon decades upon decades of cowardice in running from Brown v. Board and white supremacy in basically mandating the miseducation and undereducation of black and brown children.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.